I think it's easier if I talk English because I don't really speak German. I sometimes pretend to speak German, but I don't really do. So this talk is about Unhosted, which is a project which started about a year ago. It started with a conversation in a pub, just like many projects, I guess, with a friend of mine in Spain. And he said that the reason more and more people, more and more companies like Google and Apple are moving our data into the cloud is not just to make things easier and work better, but also to get more hold on our data and get their hands on it. And that the way things are going, desktop computing is becoming less and less of a thing in the mainstream. People buy iPads and they will be buying Chromebooks that don't have a hard disk, so your data will be in the cloud and no longer on your hard disk under your control. So that's how the Unhosted project started. So when we talked about that, I then decided to take 3 months off work and go to a tropical island and just program. Just 3 months hacker's holiday. My boss said okay. Yeah, but he probably saw that if he wouldn't say okay, then I'd just quit anyway. Because I just wanted to do it. So the original idea was to do something like with BitTorrent or something peer-to-peer, and little by little it evolved into doing encryption and other things, and so today I'll talk about what it's now. So it started with just a 3 month hobby project in Bali. And then when I came back, people said, well, you should continue, and yes, it's nice at Fostum in Brussels. And so we set up a non-profit project funded by donations. And we just, you know, program, think, and see how we can make an unhosted web and revolutionize the architecture of the web. The state of the web now is that a lot of free software enthusiasts don't use the web as much as other computer users, especially for this reason. Like, all data is in centralized platforms where it's not under our control. It's either in Facebook or in Google. And that's a layer, proprietary layer, on top of the open web. So the internet is entirely distributed and the web is also open. But on top of that, people have just been started building monopolies that are walled gardens. And the reason they have control over our data is because they give us a package deal where the application is bound to the storage. So if you want to use Facebook as an application, you have to use Facebook as a storage provider. That's a package deal. It's like saying if you want to use Windows as an operating system, you have to use Explorer as a browser. That's why these applications are given away for free, even though it costs a lot to host them. They let us use these websites for free, like Gmail, just because they give us the application and we give them our data. And especially if you're in Europe, there are privacy laws which protect our data. But it was recently in the news that if a company uses Microsoft or Amazon as their cloud provider, that even if the servers are physically in Europe, the Patriot Act would overrule the European privacy regulations. And even though under European law, if your data is in Europe, then the governments couldn't get to it. With the Patriot Act, American companies would have to give it to their government because they have access to it. And then this might surprise some people, but it's actually a real problem. Free software is very good for servers and for PCs, but it doesn't help for the problems we have on the web. Facebook is one of the worst monopolies and restrictions of our freedom as software users or as web users. But most of their stack is free software. They run in PHP, they contribute to PHP, and they use things like MySQL, Memcache, it's all free software. So we're here promoting free software, whereas the real problem on the web is not whether the software is free, it's whether those platforms are open or closed. So, and this is something that we also had talks about this at other free software conferences. And the Free Software Foundation doesn't really, their stance is more or less saying, you shouldn't use cloud computing. It's not good, it's never gonna work, so just don't do it. And so they provide a solution where if you want to be free, then you can run Debian and just unplug a network cable and then you'll be entirely free. But if you want your friends to be like your muggle friends, the people who are not programmers, if you want them to be free, how can you do it? You can tell them, okay, you can install Linux for them. Now with Ubuntu, they can even use it without being a technical person. And that works, but then they just use Ubuntu to start up their browser and go to Facebook again. And then you can tell them not to use Facebook, but it's like saying, that's what they want to do with their computer. So free software has always been like the big point of freedom in software usage, but now saying that a program should be free doesn't help us for websites to be free. We need an open web where we can choose where our data is, even if we want to use applications, specific applications. So, instead of free software licenses, the point where we attack this problem is here, the app being bound to the storage. We try to separate applications from storage. This is a slide that's I think in all presentations always. So it explains the difference between decentralization and distribution. For instance, Diaspora is an open system, an alternative to Facebook, and it's an example of a decentralized network because there's not one big center, there are several centers. But it's also not entirely equal, so it's not distributed like BitTorrent. So, we propose a decentralized architecture where even if there are still bigger and smaller servers, the user should be free to switch between them, and at any point, if you want to, be able to set up your own node. Just like with email, you can use a big email server, but you know that since SMTP is a decentralized protocol, you can always set up your own mail server should you have a need to. And separating the application servers from storage provider. So the way that goes is if this is normally people make a web server and a database server and then calculate the whole web page and send that to the browser. And that's hard to get in between. There, the data structures in the database are very much linked to the application that runs on the web server. And the way these server side, like if you have a standard LAMP-based website, then probably the way it's written, you do a lot of queries on the data because the web server is close to the database server, and then send just the presentation to the browser. So the first thing you want to do is move a lot of processing to the browser. So there's not so much server-side processing, but more client-side processing. Then that means you have to program in JavaScript because it's the language that runs in the browser. but it has the advantage that the application becomes a lot more responsive. So if you load an application once, JavaScript has become very powerful in the last 1 or 2 years. You can run pretty much anything. People have compiled Linux for JavaScript, and they run Quake and with 3D graphics, all in the browser. So the only calls, the asynchronous AJAX calls that it makes to the server is just to get data from the server. And you no longer go to the server to get a whole HTML page, but you just, that's what you do at the start, just the statics. But then once it's in your browser, any next page updates, the way websites are programmed now, it usually just asks for a JSON object, and it's just the data fields that come from the server, and then the application that runs in the browser presents that. And the good thing about that is, if the application runs in the, if the processing is done in the browser, then the application is much more responsive because it can respond to your actions without having to do a round trip the whole time. And you can, for instance, you could be, you can see that, for instance, in Gmail, when you're typing, it immediately shows up. But and then when you, and you occasionally see that it's saving, it will say working at the top. But that doesn't interrupt your interaction with the application because you and the application are on the client side, and it only pushes data, it only synchronizes data to the server. So with that architecture, it suddenly becomes a question, okay, so my application comes from here to my browser, and why should the storage which I sync with be on the same host? If I have my own data, I'm a user who has their own photos, their own address book with contacts, your own documents, why should that be inside the application? Why can't that be somewhere else? If it's separate AJAX calls anyway, then you might as well make these calls somewhere else to say the application is here and my storage is there. So that's basically what we implemented. You take an application, the user puts in their user address. That user address it's user at host, so it already contains domain name. So you use that domain name that the user puts in to say, okay, that's where we'll store your data. So each user has, if you're a user at domain, then at that domain is where your data is. Even if you go to a different website, whichever website you go to, you always log in with the same user address, and that determines where your data is. So you need a few things for that. We have a nice image of it. So this is the cloud, as you can see. And the way it is now, the applications and the data storage are in the same place. So these keys is the data, and this is the application. The data is inside the application. So like your photos are inside Facebook, your documents are inside Google Docs. Even if they offer the option to download a zip file with data liberation and other things, it's still, for practical purposes, the data is inside there. So what we want to achieve is separating them, saying I'm using this application, but whenever we need to synchronize data, it's going to another place. So I'm going to my browser. My browser visits the website, you get the application, and then you put in your username so that it knows where you have your data, and then it loads the data into the browser. That's the idea. And now it gets technical. I had a diagram of this, but I don't have that here on the. I need Wi-Fi for that. But I'll talk about the protocol stack. So this is what we need to make this work. You might have heard of some of them. So AJAX is asynchronous JavaScript traffic. When you, instead of saying every you click on a link and you go to the next page, and you click on a link, you go to the next page, refresh. You just go to a page, and when you click on something, it executes some JavaScript which calculates, okay, so I need to asynchronously get this data and load it in, and then change the page, so there's no page refresh on every click. That's Ajax. This web, basically how the web has worked for the last 5 or 10 years, maybe. Thing with Ajax is that because it started as a way to make one website more dynamic, it made sense to apply a single origin policy on that. So these asynchronous calls can only go to the same domain that you're on. It made sense at the time, it doesn't make sense now, because now we want to mesh up different domains, and these domain boundaries are just barriers to meshing up, to keeping the web open and stopping domains from becoming walled gardens. Which is why CORS was invented, cross-origin resource sharing. It's a very simple way to in which the resource you're getting asynchronously, so the AJAX resource responds with an HTTP header saying which origins are allowed to retrieve that data. So what you need to do for this is whenever you respond to an AJAX call, put some extra HTTP headers in there. That's very easy, it's just some strings you put in, and then it works. So WebFinger is, it's finger for the web. It always sounds like it's a protocol with anchor stuff, but it's actually not, it's just an XML file. It's sort of, it's like DNS for user addresses. WebFinger resolves user at host to an XML file. And that XML file can contain anything. So the way it works is very similar to robots.txt. It's a file that's always in the same place. So robots.txt, favicon.ico are the standard well-known URLs, or paths, sorry, that every domain can put them on there in the same path, and then the web will understand what they're for. And WebFinger is the same, so it's well-known/host meta, and it contains metadata about the host. So in there, you say, you give a URL where you can say, tell me stuff about this user, because I've seen that they're at the at host part of their user address, so that they're on your domain. And then you just get an XML file back or a JSON object with different types of data in there. So since this protocol already existed, we said, okay, we'll reuse that. Because all we want to do is have a user address and have a way to discover where the storage is for that user address. So we say just in the WebFinger file for a user, for your domain, just for every user address, announce where the remote storage is. And that way, an application can always find it. And the thing about WebFinger is that it's the way it's implemented by a lot of people, actually. For such an obscure and unknown protocol, it's like Google implements it, Yahoo implements it, StatusNet, Diaspora, there's a WordPress plugin. There's a lot of support for WebFinger. And if you have a Gmail address, you can just look up gmail.com/.well-known/.host-meta and follow that trail, and then you get an XML file about you. It's just public data, so it'll point to your Google profile, it will point to your OpenID, URL, I don't know what else, it's under your avatar probably. But the thing is that they don't put cross-origin, Google doesn't put cross-origin headers on there. So that's a bit counterintuitive, because WebFinger is about discovering things about users at other domains. If you're talking to your own code, then you already know everything about your own users, right? WebFinger is used to announce, and just standard XML file, about your users to other people. So it doesn't make sense to have a WebFinger file without course headers, because then basically you're saying, this is a single origin WebFinger service, which is just for me, so you might as well not publish it. And the result of that is that you can only consult WebFinger files from the server side. So if you're on a server, then you can make a curl call, because then a COCOL can always go to any domain. And basically the only place where WebFinger doesn't work is on the web, because from the browser you need a cross-domain header. So we started a campaign for that, and now that was in May, and now Diaspora and StatusNet and WordPress all support cross-domain headers on their WebFinger. Google and Yahoo don't yet. I made an app called ChromeFinger, based on James Bond, which shows how Google's WebFinger is broken. So you have to put in a user address, and if it's the Diaspora address, it will go like the bar will go like the little dots with the James Bond theme, and it will work. And the Google one will get the red blood over it. So, and I send that to them, ChromeFinger, but then they stop responding. they stopped replying to me. So then I decided. So now we'll just set up a proxy, so that you can say if anybody wants to read a WebFinger file on a domain that doesn't support course headers, then you just go through this proxy. You make the request to the proxy. The proxy makes it the request to the real place. Comes back, adds the HTTP headers, and sends it back to the browser. Of course, you have to host that proxy, and it's centralized again. You have to trust it, so it's all a pain. It'd be easier if people just implement standards. Having said that, there was a post 5 days ago that Google will look at implementing course headers on the Google Drive protocol, Google Data, it's called, I think. So there's everything. There are like 100 APIs to Google, and one of them is the Google Docs storage, which, according to TechCrunch, will soon be it's not very well known or exploited that on Google Docs you can store any file you want. So it's just a generic storage. And there's always been rumors about Google Drive, like Google offering sort of Dropbox. But now TechCrunch says that it's really going to happen, and that just Google Docs any file is going to be renamed to Google Drive, and it will be just like iCloud or SkyDrive or Dropbox and all these other services, but for Google account. And so a few days ago on a forum, somebody asked about cross-origin headers for that, and they said they'll see if they can add those. So that will be awesome. Then everybody with a Google account will have remote storage, which can be used from the browser as long as you OAuth to it. Because obviously, if you're going to open up this storage to any website, then anybody can write to it. You don't want that. You want to have the password to your own storage, obviously. And you don't want to give your passwords to all these websites, because then everybody has your passwords. The idea is that they can't control your data, and that you have control over your data. So if you give out your password everywhere so that they can connect to it, then everybody can write to it, and that's it. So that's what OAuth is for. It's OAuth gives a token, which is temporary partial access to a resource. So that's what it's for. It was invented by Blaine Cook from Twitter, started it, and the same guy who started WebFinger together with Brett Fitzpatrick, I think. So yeah, the way OAuth works is you're either redirected, and then it says allow this application access to your storage or your Twitter or whatever, and then you redirect it back, or it's a pop-up in which you say okay, allow, and the pop-up closes. Yeah. So with that, we can, if somebody puts in a user address to an application, it can resolve the WebFinger with cross-origin headers on there, and then send you to the OAuth dialog, which it discovers. There you say, okay, allow this application access to my storage, and then I will get a token, which you can revoke at any time, but that gives that application access to your storage. And then all the application has to do is get, put, and delete. We used to say WebDAV, because that seemed like the open standard for storage, and a lot of web apps would use WebDAV for their backend, especially if you have like a folder structure. But then we tried to implemented in different platforms, and it turns out that WebDAV has 11 verbs, I think, which are all, they all use XML, and it's kind of complicated. So you don't want to be programming WebDAV into everything. Mm-hmm. It's just too complicated a protocol for that. So then we said, okay, but all we want to do is store data and retrieve it, right? And yes, a folder structure is nice because then you can do searches, get the index, and say, okay, from this directory, get a subdirectory, and then get that blob. But I mean, if we don't have that, we can get over it. There are ways to get over that. You can make an index yourself saying, okay, my list of documents is this, and then you just put the keys of the documents you have. And that you're basically making then an index file on top of the key value storage. So the key value storage is just get, put, and delete. You can put something in there, get it back, and if you're bored with it, you can delete it. And if you want a listing of something, like you want to store 10 things and you have a list of those 10 things, then you just store 11 things, and 11 things is an index of the other 10. And you remember the name of the index, and through there you can always get back to your data. So that's all we need. We had, we thought we needed messaging as well, but actually the original version had so the original version I did in Bali didn't have any of this. It didn't have core. No, it did have cores. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. But it didn't have Webfinger. I didn't used that yet. It didn't have OAuth because. OAuth 1 cannot be used on the client side, and I hadn't heard of OAuth 2. And it had a key value store with get, put, delete in a custom protocol. And it also had a message queues where you can send messages sort of like PGP, encrypted with the public key of the other person. And for the key value store, you would sign everything you publish so people know that it's published by you. We sort of said, okay, well, if we do the storage layer right, then everybody else who wants to can add signatures and encryption on top of that. We don't have to specify that in our specification. So that's why we just specify the key value store, how to authenticate to it, and how to find it. And about messaging, so there's, in Federated Social Web, Federated Social Web is a movement that comes from the multitude of free software social networks that exist. You probably all know it's a lot of fun to start a free software project, and it's especially a lot of fun to start a free software project that's a social network. And the nice thing is programming it, and a lot of them. There are like 40 free software social networks, just like Diaspora, and they're all slightly different. Most of them don't have that many users. And so the question that arose was, so why, yeah, which one should be the big one that we all use? Because if it's going to win, if social networking is going to be a free software thing, which is... decentralized, then the first thing we need to do is all be on the same platform, at least so that we don't balkanize our own product. So that's how Federated Social Web was born. And there are basically two strands of it. One of it is OStatus, which is proposed by, it's basically based on the StatusNet protocol, which Identica uses. If you're on Twitter, be on Identica. It's like Twitter but free software and decentralized. And it's open, so anybody can run a node and add that. And YoStatus protocol defines, it uses PubSubHubUp, which is a way to publish and subscribe to resources with hubs. And so the first thing we thought was, okay, so if we're going to make a protocol where people can own their own data, and one of the important users for the data is going to be social things and interacting with other people. So let's make it compatible with Federated Social Web. So we looked at implementing PubSubHubUp, adding that to the spec, seeing how that would work. And then we realized that there's actually this other part of Federated Social Web, which is XMPP based. And there's like both PubSub, HubUp, and XMPP are valid. They both have advantages and disadvantages. In some situations, you would want to use one, in others, you would want to use the other. So then we realized that we couldn't dictate saying if you want to own your own data, then you have to implement PubSub, HubUp, because maybe you want to use it on XMPP. And then one realization was that these pinging infrastructures are they're transient state. They, while you're using it, they're important because they make the application work. But then while it's in rest, which is when you want to when you go back to the persistent state of owning your data, these technologies are not infringing on your freedom. You could so basically the decision was to keep those keep it up to the application how they implement pinging. We just say an application should use remote storage for storing the data, because that is what the user owns. And if you own your data but you don't own your ping, so a ping is like, if you send you a message, then I can put it in my outbox for you to retrieve whenever you come seeing if I sent you a message in the last week. But to make it work well, I have to send you a ping saying, hey, there is a new message now, so that you can come and fetch it. But we wanted to bring those pings under the user's control, but then we said it's simpler if we don't. And if you at least own your storage, and then applications can do those pings in different ways, and you will still have control over your data. So that's why there is no messaging or other stuff in our protocol. It's just the key value store. It's just about your data, getting the data out of the application. So we renamed it to remote storage last week, actually, which is a it's like your remote storage. It's where your data is. And it's some of you may have heard of local storage, which is part of the HTML5 spec. In HTML5, you can do set item and get item to local storage. It's a bit like a cookie, but it doesn't get sent to the server all the time. There's local storage, session storage, and IndexedDB. There used to be WebSQL, but that was dropped again because it didn't really work. And remote storage is just like local storage, but remote. And we provide a JavaScript library which can talk to your remote storage. And for the application, the way to interface with our library is exactly the same as interfacing with HTML5 local storage. And then the library will synchronize. It will, first of all, so you set an item into remote storage, that will return directly and already say, okay, this is now set. So your application state is always immediately updated, but it will say it's syncing. So the local situation is immediately responsive to whatever happens in the application, and it will just say working, just like Gmail. That makes applications a lot more reactive than applications that wait for the round trip time to finish and say, wait, okay, now it's been saved. So it will show up as saved immediately, and then just say working in a corner or a little spinner or whatever. And then should it fail, then it will just say not synced. So you know that if you're going to leave the page, then there'll be unsaved data. But otherwise, it just gets out of the way. And the reason we made this library with this interface is because a month ago, we got a call from the Federation of Dutch Universities and Higher Education Institutes. So they said, oh, we heard that you're doing something to free the cloud. And yeah, that sounds interesting, because universities are more, I didn't know this, because it's been a while since I was at a university. But when I was at a university, and the university started email, basically. They started offering email to their students. And they were always at the systems administrators of university were always at the forefront of software and of freedom. But now, in because it's quite expensive to run an IT department for a university, and it's not their core activity. What a lot of them do is just move to Google Apps, and the ones that don't move to Google Apps probably use to Microsoft Exchange or whatever. So all these universities are putting their student data and their staff data into Google or into Microsoft or into whatever cloud provider, and so there came this discussion among universities saying, yeah, well, we want to be in control of our data, but at the same time, if we have to employ 7 people to run it, and it still goes down, and we can just outsource it, and then it will just work, because Google does make the servers work well. Then it's a difference between ease of use and freedom. So more and more universities are going for ease of use and forgetting about the freedom of owning their data. So they said, yeah, they want to do a pilot. So there are 1 million people who have an email address at either a Dutch university or a Dutch higher education institute. And those 1 million people will have, in spring, they will get remote storage. So that means that on any application that supports remote storage, they can log in with a university email address at whatever university.nl. It redirects to their university page. They say, yes, allow this web apps to store data in my university account, and then go back to their, and they use that application. So you can use that for intranet stuff. You can set something up for your student club that uses the accounts of the actual student accounts. So that means that each user has their data at the university, you can see it there. You can migrate it out. So it's obviously runs on your university server. So if your university is evil, then and the user wants your data, then you still have the same problem as having it at Apple. But usually a university will be more ethical than a multi-billion-dollar monopoly. So they said they wanted to do this pilot. So that's great. We'll have 1 million users in spring. That's really amazing for us. The only problem was that they said, right, so what sort of things will these people be able to use then? And said, well, you have this demo app, which is called myfavoritesandwich.org, and you can choose what the ingredients are of your favorite sandwich, store it in the cloud, and you know, store it in the cloud, and unhost it on your account. And that's the only thing we have. So then we said, okay, so from now to spring, our main focus is going to be, we have to get applications. So we thought of ways of getting people to program for this API. So we defined a standard, it's all documented, just write client-side code for it. And then we found out, yeah, we looked at all those apps that exist, like there's calendar apps, text editor apps, and different web apps that all use local storage. Because if you're a web developer, then a front-end developer, then the easy way to develop an application at first is just pretend you have the backend. So you start writing the front end of an application without having a real data server behind it. And a lot of people actually use local storage as a temporary backend so that they can develop their app while they're offline, and they can just try it out with data being stored and retrieved. And then later, when it's working, they say, okay, now we add the real, and they add a Mongo or a CouchDB or a Redis, and then or something with Ruby, and then they add the backend when the application is already working. So also if people want to demo an application, say, look, this is what I did. You can try it out. I'm not going to host it because I don't want to run a server, but I just made it work with local storage so everybody can see how it works in their own browser, and you don't have to bother me with your data. And that's exactly what we can offer to app developers. If you write a local storage application, then you don't have to store data of users that use it. And with remote storage, this is the same. So you write an application, instead of writing a backend for it, you just say, okay, whenever I want to store something, remote storage.set item, and whenever I want to retrieve something, I get it from remote storage. And the rest is the actual storage backend is provided by the users that come to use your application. So this is the interface. It's basically the same as for local storage. You initialize it with the data scope, which is like, for instance, documents or pictures or contacts or sandwiches. And then it will show the user a login button where they put in the user address and they get redirected to their OAuth and they come back to your application. And then you can just use get item to get with a string to get an item from the key value store. You can set it and you can remove it. So that is all you need to develop applications for this. Just write HTML applications, wherever you search and replace local storage with remote storage, and then it will work, and people will be able to use that with their with your application. It, unfortunately, the demo is not going to work because we don't have Wi-Fi here. But I'll it's on our website, so you can check it out when you have the time. There's we have a test user which you can use to try out the demo whenever there's Wi-Fi. So, if you're an app developer, if you haven't yet tried JavaScript, try it out. It's not as stupid as it seems. Like, when JavaScript was always sort of this script, web scripting language, it was sort of like Visual Basic, or what are those others? It was just like a toy language, and it seemed like that. And like, if you're a real programmer, then you program in C or in Perl or in Python, and for the web maybe in PHP, that was respectable also, but JavaScript is just, you know, that's for just for small tags in animated pages. But a lot of people have started using JavaScript in much more advanced ways and found out that it's actually as powerful as any functional language. You can do things like similar to Erlang, for instance, or whatever. So there's Clojure, I think. There's and when you get used to it, the trick is asynchronous programming. So you write event handlers and callbacks. You say, okay, you start here, you do this, and then something that takes time, that means you exit from your execution. So you're saying, okay, I'm going to calculate what I want to retrieve, and then you retrieve it, and then you give the AJAX call a callback function, saying, okay, go get that. When you have it, continue with this function. And you can chain all these functions so that in the end it becomes like a procedural program that does things step by step. It is a bit of a, you have to switch. It took me about 6 months to get used to it. Because I'd always programmed like C++ and PHP. But now that I'm used to it, I love it. It's very easy. It works very easily in the browser. You don't need a development environment. And it works everywhere on the web. Write JavaScript apps. It's fun. And when you do, use remote storage, obviously, so that you don't have to write backends. You just write an application, and the user data is stored at the user space. You just provide the application. Come to our IRC channel. We're always there to help and help out with questions or just to talk about life and freedom and web. If you're a storage provider, which you're probably not, but you should enable course headers. If you are Amazon S3 and you provide cloud storage to users, right? So put cross-origin headers on there so that users can use it on the web. The web is open, and there are these domain boundaries. And with course headers, we're breaking down these boundaries and making the web more open than it currently is. And to make your users access their storage easily, you just provide Webfinger and OAuth. So when they put their user address into an application, it will OAuth to the storage that you're offering, and then the application will just be able to store stuff there and access stuff that was stored there from before. This is what we want to do. We want to free people from the web's monopolies. It's been a crazy year for me. I've just started a hobby project on the beach, and then suddenly it was on Hacker News, and people said, quit your job, this is it, you have to do this. They were like, oh my god, this is the project I've been waiting for. And then it's gone really well since then. We've made a lot of progress, and I really think we're on to something, and that we're on our way to free people from the web's monopolies. Thank you. I did manage to speak 45 minutes. You have a question?
Yeah, on which ISC network is the channel?
Oh, sorry, I'm free now.
Okay.
Yeah, I should have told that.
Are there any intentions to put versioning on that, or are there any apps that are actually doing it at the moment?
On the data?
On the data, yeah. So, simply put, you have a key value store with an interface,
mm-hmm.
with users and storage thingy.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I really like about Dropbox is the versioning. So, it seems kind of hard to implement. You should do that in you had to do it in the browser, didn't you?
Right now, we're experimenting with, actually yesterday we said we should add two options. One which is where the client chooses what the key is, and one is where the storage chooses what the key is. So the first case where the client used to say, I can use any key I want and store value in there. And that's the way I can address it, and then when I go back to the same key, it's still there. The second option is where you can just say, okay, store this blob for me. And then the storage says, okay, I have stored it here, and it gives you either the hash that's the digest of that blob, or something it decides based on its own decisions. And that's a very low level, that's almost like the level of a hard disk. So on top of that is what would be a file system and what would be versioning. There's obviously the issue if you do versioning on the other side of the wire that you have to. So it's easy to, especially in this, if you have a content address, if the server chooses the file name or you don't change the versions on the same file name, you say, okay, store this new blob. I say, I have stored it, and then. Then after that, you can do an atomic operation where you say, okay, from now on, that blob is the new value for this thing. And then, that can be appended to the history. And it's a thing we want to, like CouchDB includes versioning in the way it works. So even whatever you do, if you implement, like we're implementing CouchDB as a remote storage as well. So there you would have versioning just below the key value store, but the application can get to that.
Yeah.
But in case you lose your data.
An API call that. You would have to provide an API call.
Yeah, or we'd have to say, okay, we're implementing remote storage. By the way, we use CouchDB, so should you want to use the version, then you can use normal CouchDB protocol. But that would divide people into CouchDB and WebDAV and different backends. So, for now, the idea is make the other option is to put that into the client-side library so that any application that uses it gets it for free, but on the client side, but all in the same standard way, so you don't forget about it. And obviously the basic option is for every application to implement it. That's always an option. It's a trade-off between keeping the protocol simple and obviously versioning is something we want to have. Yeah?
Are there options for locking the data on the server side so no concurrent process can alter the data there?
The idea is that all data is owned by users, The ideas that those use are physical persons. So unless you type with two hands, you're never going to get concurrency problems, because you're always on one physical person will only be on one tab or one browser at the same time. And you would get concurrency problem if you start to collaborate. So, and on a normal server backend, then well, you have all your users in the same place, centralized. Then concurrency is obviously a problem because it all interacts with each other. But because every user has their own storage, it's like, do you ever have the problem where you're saving the same file from two applications at the same time? Like you have two windows open and you click save in both at the same time on your own hard disk? That doesn't happen. So by saying all data is owned by just one user, you get rid of concurrency problems. There can still be, obviously, if there's a request that was still pending and then the next one comes in and it comes in too late, then we just use timestamps to say whatever was last is authoritative per key value. So that is definitely related also to distributed versioning, because as soon as you cache, you can always get forks of data in different places. So you have used your laptop while it was not connected, and it did say it's not syncing, so you know that, but you've used it anyway, and then on the same time you've been using your phone with your storage and make different edits, and now there you have diverged. What we do then is we use this, and it's the same as in a normal local storage protocol. We trigger a storage event to tell the other person, saying, hey, this key was edited after you edited. This is the old value, this is the new value. So deal with it. If you want to alert your user saying the document has changed since you opened it, then do you want to reload? Some, like, I think gedit does that, right? If it changes on disk, it say, hey, do you want to reload next time you're back? So we provide storage events for that. That's the same as the local storage provides. But in general, we try to, and this is always per key. So if the if you have one big key, which is an entire list of all your calendar events, then you will often get changes that override other changes. But if you say, I'm going to make each event a separate item, then only if you edit a calendar event would you be in danger of getting a distributed versioning conflict. So the application has control, first of all, by implementing the storage events, saying whenever there is a change, you can consult the user or think about what to do about it, how to resolve the conflict, and by designing your data in a way which is, say, each key value pair is a unit that makes sense in the application, and not an entire list of stuff that are unrelated, then you also minimize that problem.
And another point regarding, you already mentioned collaboration, how would you implement that with unhosted?
Somebody did that on Wednesday. They took Etherpad Lite, which is Etherpad rewritten on Node.js. It's about 200 times smaller memory footprint, I think. Node.js is for those who don't know, V8 engine is the JavaScript engine of Chrome and Chromium, and it's very powerful. That the V8 engine was a big cause of why JavaScript suddenly became so big this year. I mean, JavaScript became really big this year. BlackBerry is no longer doing BlackBerry apps. They're telling, if you're developing BlackBerry apps for BlackBerry phones, start writing them in JavaScript. And RIM says that there will be the web OS that never was. Windows says, if you want to write an application for Windows 8, write it in JavaScript. GNOME says, if you want to write stuff in the GNOME shell, write it in JavaScript. JavaScript is really everywhere, and it's the language that so many people write it, it's easy to get started with it. It's everywhere. Anyway, it's also on the server in Node.js. So somebody took, Ryan Dahl, I think, took the V8 engine, put it on a server, and said, okay, I'm going to write a web server in JavaScript, in a JavaScript, use V8 as a JavaScript interpreter, that then runs a web server on the server side. Anyway, somebody took Etherpad Lite and put a remote start backend on there, and we ran that and it worked. So you have an Etherpad instance, so you'd still need a server, right? So there's the people, then there's one server which runs Etherpad, that dissolves all the editing and the colors and stuff, and then the storage backend is the remote storage of one of those people. So one person starts a document, says, okay, I'm going to start a document on my server, and you can all come edit it. I'm going to edit it through this Etherpad Lite server. We call it Azulpad, because the nickname of the guy that is on IRC is Azul. So that's one way of doing it, putting a server in between, handling everything, all the collaboration first, and then funneling it to one stream of changes, which then goes to our remote storage. Another way of doing it would be to say, whenever multiple people are online, we're going to communicate through XMPP, and one of us gathers all the changes and then writes it to remote storage. And the other people don't write directly, but they just send XMPP to this one master. If the master person leaves the chat or the collaboration, then somebody else becomes the master until there's one person left, and then you don't have collaboration anymore, then it's just normal editing. We haven't tried this, this is just an idea, saying because collaboration is relevant, you say, okay, we want to work together on this document. But if I write a document, I close it, you open it, you write it, you close it, I open it, and if we're not in there on the same time, then it's suddenly a very easy problem. We just say, okay, I have to just see where you left off. When I come back, it checks the new state, saying, oh, this is now the state, edit and save. But in collaboration becomes hard when it's real time. Then we want to immediately see the edits happen. So the idea we had, do the real-time edits through XMPP, and do the rest just with versioning, saying somebody always owns the version, and saying this is a fork of my document which has your edits, and is now the latest version of the thing we're collaborating with. So that's two options basically, one XMPP or Azulpad are two options for collaboration. Yeah?
But I think you said that encryption is not directly part of unencrypted.
Yeah. A lot of people were that sort of disappointed by that, because encryption is cool. Oh, sorry, I like to ask you a question.
Well, the first thing is, the storage provider would, if I don't encrypt, I would have to trust them more than I would trust Facebook or anyone currently.
Why more?
Because I give them the data and they could manipulate it, or they could steal the data if I encrypt it, but it's not authenticated or private privacy. So that's just that's the reason I have to trust them equally, I think.
Mm. You have to trust Facebook a lot to use Facebook.
I don't use Facebook.
Yeah. I know, but that's, here at Datenspoor, probably everybody here knows about these things and takes their message, but we have friends who we also want to be free. So I said that. I'll come to your question. So the encryption is the way that would work. The reason we took it out of, the reason didn't have any slides about it is that if you get encryption wrong, then it's really easy to fuck up a lot. Like if I would write an encryption library, I would probably get it wrong, and then and if people will start using it in production, they will all have the same bug. But having said that, one of the advantages of separating storage from application is that the application could use encryption and just only store encrypted data. So you could do encryption at the data, at the application level.
Yeah, but wasn't there also, I just seen it on, I'm not so much into crypto, so, but just, I think it was related to unhosted, and I, sometime I thought that I was, it was a main part and some kind of signing and, in a kind of not attributed way or,
there was, I did several, that was, I call that star sign, the way, like a weird way to do a public key infrastructure. It was that, at the start, what I started doing was end-to-end encryption. That's how it started. And then later, when other people started talking about it, say, oh, so you're separating the application from the data. Yeah, we're encrypting it. Yeah, but you're separating the application from the data. That's what we do. Think of it that way. Actually, that is the important part. And that, so that's how that evolved.
To really I'm not sure if they want encryption on the application side, because the main goal here is that I own the data, and if the application encrypts the data, I can't read it. The application can read it.
It could be.
I want to read the data. I want to have access to my data.
Yeah.
So I think the encryption should not be on the applications.
Well, if you're going to use encryption at the application level, then what you probably do is get the application from a Git repository, put it on your local host, and you just use it on your local host. So it never leaves you. The only thing that ever leaves your device is the encrypted data. But there is a related problem to that. Saying you have a photo application, and then you suddenly want to use different photo applications, and you say, oh, but I already have all my holiday photos of the last 12 years in my remote storage in this just normal standard data format by this own application. And this other application could just use the same format, and then multiple applications, you would get instant data liberation. If you have just one set of photo albums, just one contacts list, just one set of documents, and wherever, whatever application you go, we define a few standards saying, well, pictures is just called pictures, and it should have this structure. Contacts is called contacts, it should be vCards. Then you can use data across applications, and that becomes, then the web suddenly becomes what we already have on the desktop, which is just have your own home folder, your own My Documents, if you call them Windows. So if you want to do that, then encryption becomes a barrier to that, because one application would encrypt and the other application wouldn't be able to read it. So then we thought about doing sort of a layer in the middle, which is like a in between the storage. So do the storage, then the encryption layer, and then on top of that do applications that get the decrypted information. That could work. It all depends on the way you want to use it. We focus on getting the remote storage protocol out there, both to JavaScript developers and to storage providers, and everything else can be done on top of that as it evolves. That's the idea. Did you have a
question? Do I understand it right that you have just one remote storage per person?
You could have more, but then it becomes annoying again. You could have 5 or 6.
Isn't that a great weakness? Because now I just have to trust Facebook with my social network, and now I have to trust some remote storage provider with my social network, with my secret tower.
Right, so yeah, like putting all your eggs in one basket.
So.
It's yeah. like putting on an ice on that. Yeah. It could be. There's if you make this, it's always the thing with single sign-on. This is like remote storage is single storage, just like single sign-on. And with single sign-on, the counter argument is always, so yeah, if I leave my computer open and I'm logged into my single sign-on, then all my websites are open, not just the ones I used, but also the ones I didn't use today, just because there's one sign-on that anybody who gets my computer doesn't get one website or what happens to be open, they get all of it. That's true on the desktop anyway. And if somebody steals your laptop and you've been using everything on your own local hard disk, then everything is in the same place. You could use multiple user addresses. Say you have a university address, you have a personal address, and a CCC address, and they use them for different things. You could have multiple copies if you're afraid of losing the data. I guess what you want to do if you say, okay, I want my work to see my work stuff and my friend who runs the server wherever to see my social stuff, then you just use two user addresses, a personal and a work one. And then, but then the downside is you cannot, if you want to have a work photo in your private thing, then you have to move it across. So the usability, it's a user's choice. Really, if you say I want to spread the risk and say have different things in different places, then you can, obviously. But we want, we sort of promote people to do just one storage. That would be easiest.
Time's up.
Probably.